Hello, everybody. My name's Rosa. Thank you all for coming. I didn't think I was going to be nervous. I wasn't nervous. Now I'm nervous. What I want to do today is just share with you what has happened to me as a result of being exposed to this program, and to give you some picture of how direct my higher power has had to be. And for good reason. I came here very well grounded in arrogance. I was certain that I was right all the time, and that's what I was supposed to be. And so I spent all of my time trying to look perfect and being absolutely terrified that somebody might be able to look behind the scenes and notice that on the inside there was nothing but this quivering jelly. I was always expecting that you would see the flaw, and then, knowing who I really was, you wouldn't want to have anything to do with me. That was crazy making. It was definitely crazy making. And before I found my way to Al-Anon, I did, I believe, become totally insane. So when I got here and I heard those words and the steps, I didn't have any trouble recognizing that that could be the case. I felt crazy, and most of my time when I wasn't right in front of somebody was spent being hysterical, screaming hysterical, crying hysterical, and that was a state in which I don't believe I could have continued to exist very much longer. I was in a relationship with a drinking alcoholic by that time, and he went into a recovery program, and when he did, I was invited to participate in the family outreach portion of that program. And I flatly refused. I was angry, and I was certain that it was all his problem, and I was absolutely sure that with him locked up and under control, that my life would suddenly come clear and everything would be fine. So I stayed far, far away from anything that they had to offer that might have given me a clue that there was some reason why I was in that relationship. Near the end of his 28-day stay, I, for some reason, accepted a phone call. And he convinced me that, as I well knew, he was required to go to a meeting every day. He was not allowed to drive. And that everybody, all the drivers, had left. And if he didn't get to a meeting, they were going to throw him out. Then he would have to go to jail. So would I just come and drive him to a meeting? And I did. It didn't occur to me that bringing him from Santa Cruz to Scotts Valley, where we lived, was a bit odd. There were a lot of AA meetings we could have gone to in Santa Cruz, but I didn't stop to think about that. We went into the meeting, we sat down, the meeting began, and all of a sudden I thought, wait a minute, this doesn't sound right. It wasn't an AA meeting at all. It was an Al-Anon meeting. As sick as this man was, he knew that I was sicker on that day. And for all of the harm and damage that his disease created in our relationship, behind his drinking, there really was a tremendous and deep love in him for me. And he knew by then that he could not fix me, that his drinking was a problem, and that he could not be for me what he had been trying to be. And he had an inkling that the 12-step program was a place where I might find the way out. And so his sort of last-ditch stand was to plunk me in there and see what happened. And from that moment, my higher power began speaking straight, strong words that I could not miss. That day was in the month of September. But the meeting chair was on a page in the One Day at a Time, which was April 8th. April 8th was the day this man and I were married. I, you know, took notice when they said it was April 8th. I thought, oh, you know, I began to suspect he set this up. I had no idea how powerful my higher power was. But I'd just like to read to you that day in the One Day at a Time, just to let you see how straightforward and direct my higher power is. He doesn't hedge any bets, and he doesn't give me any place to squirm out. He makes real sure that the message is clear. That day reads, "Would I stand on the seashore and, like King Canute of the ancient legend, try to command the tides? It is just as fruitless to try to control the alcoholic. Yet this is what I would be doing in attempting to force sobriety by my willpower. I must honestly admit that I'm not even able to control my own thoughts, words, and actions. There is much room for improvement. My first obligation is to make a truly satisfying life for myself. To do this, I must work on my own shortcomings, get on better terms with myself and those around me. I will devote myself to overcoming my flaws of character and controlling my impulsive words and actions. This will leave me no time to concern myself with remodeling the alcoholic. Once I withdrew my interference and protection, the alcoholic may realize that sobriety must be a personal, individual problem which no one else can solve for him. I pray for the wisdom to know that no other person's salvation depends upon me, but on himself and God." So that was my introduction to what this program is about. And then this lady proceeded to tell my story. I said, you know, nobody's got a life like mine. I mean, I wouldn't divulge anything to anybody about my private life because it was so sordid that you would definitely not want to have anything to do with me if you knew anything about it, and there couldn't be anybody else in the world living like that. And here's this perfect stranger telling my story. So that terminal uniqueness that I came in with got right out from under me immediately. And the idea that this person who now was able to smile and laugh and to whom people came after the meeting and gave hugs and continued to love and accept her was the beacon of hope that kept me coming back. I was very, very uncomfortable in that room, but there wasn't any doubt that there was no mistake in my being there. Immediately, a couple of people who had been around the program a long time came up and introduced themselves. And now when I look back, I see those two people were my volunteer sponsors from the beginning. I was far too sick to be able to ask for a sponsor or even to know that I should. But here were these folks who were a long time in the program, were very, very involved in service. And all they did was say to me, "We're going to such and such. We're leaving at this time. Get in the car." I had long since forgotten how to say no to anything, so I got in the car. Fortunately, these were good things to say yes to. So I found myself immediately immersed in service. Well, all of a sudden, here were new pieces of time when I was not hysterical. And these were pieces of time when I didn't know the rules. So it was okay when I was at work because there were definite rules and they protected me from you. I just stepped into that role, I put on that mask, and I could do that. And whenever I was out in any kind of a visible forum, I was the president. So I stood up here, and I had my mask, and you were, you know, at arm's distance, and nobody questioned that, and that's how I kept safe. Doing service, I was walking into places I didn't have a clue what we were doing. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I didn't know what I was supposed to sound like or look like. I just showed up. And minute to minute, people asked me to do this or that. And they accepted me and believed that I'd be able to do it. And if I didn't do it well, they just gave me some more instructions. And it was quite amazing to me that that could happen. So slowly, without my even knowing anything about what this program is made of or how to participate in it, things began to change. I began to have more and more little spaces where I felt safe, where my head wasn't constantly spinning or where I wasn't backing off in total fear. And I began to see that when people looked at me without any mask on, they didn't run in terror or throw up or do anything like that. You know, I looked normal to them, and they were willing to accept me just the way I was. And that's how my higher power gently led me to the idea that I might be able to accept me too. I noticed that I never looked in the mirror. I noticed that I had stopped going to stores to shop. I couldn't step inside that dressing room with just me in the mirror and this light. I couldn't do it. And as I noticed that, I also noticed that the mirror that I saw when people in the program were standing in front of me and looking at me was okay. There wasn't horror, there wasn't suspicion, there wasn't, you know, anything that looked like I might not be okay. But when one of these folks who was acting as my sponsor at that time suggested that I might start taking some actual movements toward recovery by looking at myself in the mirror every day and saying, "Good morning, Rosa, I love you," I thought, well, that sounds easy enough, you know. It was not easy. I thought I would die, you know. When I actually looked in that mirror and tried to stand there and actually look in that mirror long enough to just say those few words, I realized how far from me I had come and how little I was able to care for me. And when I noticed that, I began to understand how I could have existed in a relationship for an extended period of time in which there was a great deal of verbal and physical abuse. I felt comfortable in that because when I began to look at me, I noticed that I had taken personally. See, I thought that I had a lot of power. I thought that I had a lot of power, that what I did affected everybody around me. And so if anybody around me was failing without recognizing it consciously, unconsciously, I thought I was responsible for that. I mean, I couldn't have all this power to control what you did if I wasn't responsible for your outcome. So when I looked back at my past and I saw broken marriages and I saw children getting in trouble, or I saw organizations having strife, I kept taking on all of that guilt, the responsibility for the failures. Somehow I never ever was able to take on good feelings about any of the successes that I could easily allow to be somebody else's. The successes were because that person did their part or that person did their part. And the behavior and the verbalization in the relationship with that final alcoholic that got me here reinforced that every day. that all the good stuff was his and the bad stuff was mine. And it was like brainwashing. And gradually, I began to behave the way he described me. And then it was true. I did behave that way. Then I looked at my behavior and I said, oh, gosh, he's right. You know, it's this insidious kind of thing. So as I started to do a lot of service with these folks, that got closed down, not by anything that I did, but just because I wasn't there as much. And so I noticed pretty soon that what had said in here about having a life had started to happen to me without my doing anything about it. And it's a good thing, because I certainly didn't have any strength or any ground to stand on to try to create that for myself. The only thing that I was able to do was to keep showing up. I went to a meeting every single day those first 2 years of the program, simply because that's the only way I could get through a whole day and have a safe place in it. And then there got to be these bigger pieces of time because I went to do service, and I could be okay in those times. I remember when I first came in Sundays, we didn't have meetings, and I talked to one of these people who was sponsoring me and noticed that regularly on Sunday I was going crazy, you know, and finally I verbalized to her, you know, I can't get through Sunday. I don't know what's going on. She said, well, there's no meetings on Sunday, so we could fix that. Let's make a meeting on Sunday. There must be other people who have trouble getting through Sunday. So she found a place, and we went and sat there, and today, many years later, that meeting still exists, and there are a lot of people who have trouble with Sunday. So that was a real vote of confidence that whatever I needed, you know, there were other people who shared that need, and they would be happy to get together with me, and we could do whatever we needed to do. So we did that. Then there came along this assembly. I'd been in the program about 6 months, and it was coming time for assembly, and the group rep in my group wasn't able to go, and asked, since I went with these folks everywhere, and they were going to assembly, would I mind representing our meeting at assembly? I didn't know what I was saying yes to, but I said, sure, I'm going to be there, you know, I'll go. So I went. That assembly was on my birthday, on my belly button birthday. The room number was the month and year that I was born. And I said, oh, you know, here's another one of those right between the eyes, this is for you, baby, messages from my higher power. So I paid attention. And during that assembly, I met the people who were really strong forces in Alateen. I met them in a very headstrong and rebellious way. And tempers flew, and it was a real adrenaline rush. It was quite an experience. And Alateen turned out to be a key service for me all the rest of the time that I have been in the program. And currently, my service position in my district is that I'm the Alateen coordinator. Those folks with whom the tempers flew that day became some of my closest friends and supporters almost immediately. In the same weekend, you know, we all had to practice the owning our stuff and making our amends and going forward. And that was my first experience in working the 12 steps. I got to do all 12 of them on this one issue right there on the spot. Well, what that did for me was say, hey, I lived through it. You know, I did all these things and I lived through it. So then when I came back home, I asked one of those two people who'd been taking me everywhere, would you be my sponsor? And I admitted that they had been doing it informally all along, and I apologized for just taking that for granted and taking advantage of it and not actually asking them was okay with them. and they said yes. And then we began the process of actually working the steps. And things really began to change for me at that point. And it was a good thing, because shortly after that I was asked to sponsor the first of my Alateen meetings. And all of my arrogance and my control issues and my I know how to do this kind of stuff came up, and they fired me. These kids fired me. And today, you know, I'm really grateful that we have empowered our young people to speak up and to not take abuse and to know that they know what they need and they have a right to say so. Those young people fired me, but they also directed me to come to this conference that year, which is my first conference, and go to the workshops on Alateen sponsorship. They said, you know, probably someday you'll be a good sponsor. But not our meeting. And they kept to that, you know. Every time I run into those kids, they give me a hug, and they're all grown up now, but they'd give me a hug, and they'd say, keep coming back, and do Alateen. You'll do okay. Just don't come and do our meeting. And I never did go back and do their meeting. Sometimes they would come and chair the meeting I was doing, but that was really a very, very loving thing for them to do. It would have been easy for them to rescue me and for me to get dependent on them and all of that. But the way they did it was so non-personal. It wasn't personal. But it was very direct and it was honest. And they gave me the solution. You know, they didn't just condemn me. They gave me a solution. And by then, I was practiced enough at listening and I had already agreed with my sponsor that when I was asked to do something in service, if there was not a life-threatening reason why I couldn't actually carry it out, I would try. I would say yes, and I would try. So I did. I went to those meetings. I listened. And sitting in the room today is one of the people who was an Alateen sponsor at the time. And I remember really feeling shaky and hurt and talking to him at this conference and him encouraging me to go to the meetings and it would be okay and all of that. And in time, another couple of years down the road after I had sponsored some other meetings, it ended up that he and I co-sponsored a meeting that had gotten very large. And so that was was kind of the circle coming round. And that was a really nice experience for me. Those are the kinds of balance that I've experienced in my whole program, that whenever I'm being asked to look at some things that are scary or difficult in life, my higher power also gives me some good stuff to balance it out so that it's really clear that I'm not alone and that this is a growth process that is for my benefit. It's not a punishment. You know, I came in really having a lot of difficulty with the words about God and the spiritual side of this program because I was raised in a religious environment. And I didn't know there was a difference between religion and spirituality. And so I was a little scared about that. And one of my tasks early on was to start kind of getting comfortable with the idea that I don't have to walk through my life alone, that this higher power, this God that's in the steps was a benevolent being who loved me, who had my good, my greater good in mind. And so I was asked to just say thank you every time that anything good was going on, that I didn't have anything to do with it, that I didn't make happen. Everything, no matter how small. And so I started practicing that. And what that did for me is make me aware that in the worst of times in my life, there are far more good things going on than the bad things. So my gratitude list is this long, and the thing that used to be this entire mountain around which I could not see is just this big. And that balance, that perspective, allows me to keep going and to just take from that challenging situation the part that belongs to me and work through that and leave the rest to the other people who are involved. Life has a way, you know, of just going on. And when I came here, I must have heard over and over and over again in the first few months that these steps were not going to make life perfect. That life was going to keep on being life. But what it was going to do for me was it was going to allow me to be comfortable in my skin, living life on life's terms. And that was the first way that I began to see how that works. That when I get that balance, I can see that it's not personal, the problem that's going on, that it's not a punishment for me, that I'm not responsible for that life is what it is. I'm just responsible for staying in my shoes and walking through my stuff one day at a time. So the next thing that I had to do was to find out where my shoes were. And so I was told, you know, to think about the first step is mind your own business. To figure out what that means. What is your business? And your business is just what is right in front of your nose at any given moment. So when your head is churning around and you're confused, you don't know what to do next, or you're busily planning what you're going to say when you get to the next place, or you're remembering how this came out last time, that the thing to do is to stop, close your mouth, look down, find your shoes, get your knees over your shoes and your hips over your knees and your shoulders over that and your head on top, and then look up and see where you are, and then deal with that right there in front of you. That's your stuff. That's so simplistic, but it works for me. It gets me rooted right here where I am. And then I discover that all those 1 minutes are totally handleable. It's when I think of them as big chunks of time that they steamroll over me and I get scared and I can't handle it. So I began to really practice that, and I continue to practice that today. When I was asked to come and speak for you today, that was about 6 months ago, and I chuckled when I picked up the phone and there was the message. Because one more time, I tend to have externalized in my body things that are not being handled. And so I was dealing with a tumor in my throat, and I was getting ready for an operation. And so it wasn't entirely certain that I was going to be able to talk, let alone that I would even be alive now, when I got that call. So I thought, well, I wonder, should I wait to answer till after the operation, see if I can talk? And then I remembered that, you know, my higher power knows what he's doing, so I just say yes. There's no reason why I shouldn't say yes. And when I get there, if I can't talk, well, okay. And then I thought, well, maybe, you know, this is the balance. I'll probably live till now, and I'll probably be able to talk. And maybe I will have learned something that's worth talking about. So I said, okay, I would do it. On the day that I was in the hospital, having gone through the operation, found out everything was fine, and that I could indeed talk, and I was going to be fine. So I got a phone call that my son had been picked up on murder charges. And I thought, I wonder if I've missed something here. You know, what is all this? And then I remembered, now wait a minute, don't take this personally. You know, this is an event, and it is not happening to you. Your job is to heal from this operation. So just do that. And your relationship with your son is to love him unconditionally. Period. And then I remembered that I had a person that I had been sponsoring who had this very same thing happen in their life, and their son was serving a prison term. And I had started sponsoring that person because my spouse at the time was in prison. And now, here it's coming round the other way. Well, this person that I had been sponsoring now has many experiences that can be very helpful and supportive to me. And again, I'm reminded, I'm not sent in here to deal with something in my life without the solutions, without the things, the tools that I need to walk through them. And so all I need to do is keep showing up every day, practice my program, talking to people, and telling the truth. And that's what I've been doing. And I kept thinking, you know, the trial was supposed to have happened already, and, well, maybe that's what I'm going to be here talking to you about, you know, how that all came out. And so 2 weeks ago, they moved the trial date again, so it still hasn't happened. We don't know what's going to happen. So I guess that wasn't what I was going to be talking to you about today. But there have been some really important things in the experience of watching that happen. Because what it gave me an opportunity to do was to watch the hand of a higher power in somebody else's life. One of the places I've had a really hard time in my program is seeing how to step out of my children's lives. I could apply it to the adults fairly easily, but to step out of my children's lives was really hard for me to do. And this one, you know, this is my youngest child, my baby, and I have a lot of amends to make to this child because he experienced a lot of abandonment from me. He was very young when I first came into the program, and I was really insane, and I felt that I couldn't spend any time with him because my insanity would damage him more than not having me in his life. And so I withdrew from his life, and he went to live with his dad in that divorce, and they were right there on the same property, but we didn't have contact. And it was a couple of years that went on like that until one day he called me up. He was 7 years old, and he called me up, and he said, "Mom, I know you're crying a lot, and that's okay. You're my mom, and I need you. And so I'm going to come and see you." He said, "I don't know why you would think that crying would make me not want to be there. You never ran away from me when I cried." It was a really powerful lesson that this little boy taught me. And he came. He said, "I'm coming, and if you need to cry, go ahead and cry. But I'm going to be around you because I need to be around you." And so he came. And I swore, well, while I was waiting for him to come, that I wouldn't cry, right? And of course, I mean, you know, I couldn't even wait at the house. I mean, I started walking toward where he would be coming from. And then running, you know, we're running toward each other and we're crying, and greeting each other. And in that process of being together and crying, began to recognize that tears are a very powerful expression, and they are a healing thing. They're a gift from God. Tears are, in fact, a physical way of getting rid of toxins in our bodies. And that the tears that I was crying were healing me without my having to dredge up and look at all and re-experience all of those hurtful things. But just to let them pass away, to let my tears bathe me in God's love, and just let all of that hurt pass away. And they also can express incredible joy, you know. That contact that occurred with this little boy on that day was so powerful. And as time went along, we learned how to check in. That's how I learned how to do reality checks. He would come and we would be together and the tears would come and he would say to me, "Mom, did those tears have anything to do with me?" And I would say yes or no, depending on what the truth was. And most of the time it was no. They don't have anything to do with you, and I don't really know what they have to do with. They're just there. And we would go right on doing whatever it was that we were doing. And the tears would roll down my face. But they didn't consume me, and I was not incapacitated by them. And it was a huge shift from that hysteria where the screaming and the tears were totally incapacitating. I couldn't breathe, I couldn't think, I couldn't be anywhere. And that was being healed over that time. Well, during that time, he and I made a kind of communication that I had never experienced before, an honesty that allowed me to be exactly what I was. I didn't have to be powerful. I didn't have to always know how to do things. I didn't have to be the perfect parent or even a grown-up, you know, in the sense that grown-ups always know how to do things. And at the same time, I could be his mother and he could feel safe and we could talk over things. And what it did was it allowed him to feel his feelings and express his feelings so that when he was angry, he could be angry
And we both knew that it wasn't me, it wasn't at me, but it was safe for him to say, I'm angry at you and what you're doing right now, and know that he could love me at the same time. And so, over time, that has been really powerful. In my Alateen sponsorship days, you know, one of the things I heard was a lot that siblings can't do very well in an Alateen meeting together. One of the first Alateen meetings I was given was an Alateen meeting that was attached to a recovery program, and it had all ages of kids. And at one space of time for about 8 months, that entire meeting was one family. It was a family of 10 children with active alcoholism. They were living in campgrounds. They would call me every week and say, here's where we are. I would go and pick them up. As many of them as could fit in the car would come, and we would do the meeting. And gradually, they worked out among them how to spread it around so that the kids who were getting fired at the most that week would be the ones who got the meeting. And those kids would get into that car, and they would detach from each other, and they would come to that meeting, and they would speak their truth, and they would look for their solutions in the literature, and they might be talking to about the behavior of the person right across the way from them. But this program works. Those kids knew they were sick. They knew they needed help, and they knew the help was in these steps and in that literature. And they were able to detach from that family situation and be safe in that meeting and grow. I saw those kids rally around and vote among themselves to choose the one boy who was having the most trouble and was about to end up in jail, and write a letter to the grandparents, who could only take one, and ask the grandparents, would they take this boy so he could go to school? Because they were being, you know, homeschooled and everything. So he could go to school. And the grandparents said, okay, they would take him. And they put all their money together and they bought him a new set of clothes and a bus ticket, so he could go and have a chance. And that, every time I think life is tough for me, you know, or somebody says, will this program work for, or should we change the words of, and I say, no, this program works just the way it is, and it'll work for anybody who needs it. And they'll be the only ones who know if they need it. You know, you just keep doing it just the way it is. And those who need it will take it up, and they'll use it no matter how old or how young. We don't need to worry about that. A lot of the hope that I have needed over time when my life gets tough has come through Alateens, through their ability to just tell it the way it is. I am so grateful for having been fired by that first Alateen group and loved while I learned how to do it, so that I kept on doing what was the thing that needed the most healing. I raised 6 children, and I was very, very sick while I was raising them. I did them a lot of harm, totally inadvertently. After I'd been in the program 2 years, I went home and I brought a friend with me who was also in the program. And in the morning, this friend said to me, do you know what your dad does first thing in the morning? And I, light went on, realized that as long as I could remember, the first thing my dad did in the morning was take a drink. But it was 2 years in the program before I realized that I had grown up in a household of alcoholics, that it wasn't that final alcoholic that got me here, really. I had that disease from before I was born. As I noted that, from that moment on, I began to notice that all the family stories, same stories they told all of my life, were full of alcoholism. When the stories would start, obviously, I went off to some imaginary place because I was hearing these stories brand new, like I'd never heard them before. It gave me a lot of understanding about how I got to be the way I was. And as I began to share that with my children, what they started to do for me to help me heal those behaviors that are automatic because I learned them right from my mother. And I was a good student. I learned them very, very well. I could do them perfectly. I couldn't see them, you know. I didn't know. I hated those behaviors in my mother. I hated them. And I studied them so hard that I really became a master at them. So my children would start to stop me in mid-sentence or whatever, and they'd say, "Mom, is that what you think, or is that Grandma talking?" And then I have to sit there and you know, go through that idea and realize that I had handed down to these children as a whole cloth things that I had never even thought about myself, whether I agreed or disagreed with the principles that I was passing on to them. I just accepted them and passed them on. So I got to stop and sort out. And then I had a conversation with this young child, the youngest, one day, and we were coming home. We ended up with him being in an Alateen meeting I was sponsoring. We both moved to that meeting the same week without realizing that that was going to happen. I had been real careful to stay out of his meetings, thinking, well, it works for everybody else, but, you know, a parent and a kid shouldn't be in the same meeting. So I had stayed in preteen, in teen, while he was in preteen. When he became a teenager, I went to the preteen meeting. And then this big meeting needed a sponsor, and I had a co-sponsor in the preteen meeting, so I said, yeah, I would go. The same week, my son decided that the meeting he had been going to was encouraging his disease, his silliness and stuff, and so he was going to switch to a new meeting where they would help him stay more honest, and we both arrived at this meeting. So we had to sit down and talk that over, and I asked him, you know, I said, this is your meeting, and so it's up to you how you feel about this. And he said, well, I don't know. What I'd like to do is ask the kids in this meeting if they will help us. If they see that I'm not working a program here or that you're not working a program here, that they'll call us on it. So I said, great, that's fine. And they said, and then he said, and if there's a time when there's an issue that I don't want to talk about in front of you but I need to talk about, we'll get an adult from the Al-Anon meeting to come in and you'll go out so I can talk. I said, fine. Okay, so we made that agreement. And that meeting allowed us to get a lot of clarity about what was going on. And he would say things in that meeting that he didn't have the courage to say to me, to my face, because we knew that what you see here, who you see here, what you say here, when you leave here, let it stay here. That was our rule. He could talk about his stuff in there. And when we left, I couldn't talk to him about it unless he brought it up. And in that exercise, we developed a trust with each other that is absolutely incredible. And I don't know any other way we could have done it. But it did work. And we had some of our best meetings driving home in the car from that meeting. When he lived through that and nothing happened with it, and then he would have the confidence to talk more about it and to get honest with me. And sometimes what he would share was, you know, I lied to my mom or I tricked her into this or tricked her into that. And, you know, people in that meeting often didn't have any idea that we were mother and son. And sometimes outside the meeting they would hear him calling, and people come over and say, you're his mom. So we knew the program was working, you know, that we were in there to do what we were in there to do. And we were able to leave our personal stuff outside. Today, when he's in jail dealing with this situation, that practice of trusting him with his own life is wonderful for me. You know, without all those years of knowing that he has his own higher power and he works through these things on his own, I'd be a basket case, I'm sure. I'm not. And without those years, I think that he would not be able to really know that I trust him and I love him, and it doesn't matter to me what the truth is. I mean, I don't know what the truth is. But whatever the truth is, and whatever his consequences are, I love him. And I know that this experience is God's work, you know, that good will come out of this. And it already is. You know, I see him learning how to read, which he couldn't do before. I see him learning about human nature. He talks to me about how important his Alateen program has been to him, you know. He said, when I first got in here, I was afraid to pray because I haven't gone to meetings in a long time. And I thought, you know, God won't want to talk to me because I abandoned him. And then it got so bad, Mom, I tried sleeping all the time. But that felt so bad, I said, well, I got to stay awake, and if I stay awake, I can't do it alone, so I guess I'll pray. And I prayed, and you know what I found out? God doesn't care what I did yesterday or what I do in the next 5 minutes. If I'm talking to him now, he's right here. He's right here, and I'm okay. I'm going to be okay. Even if I have to live in prison the rest of my life, I'm going to be okay. And I watched this young man blossom in this situation. I can't believe it. Without this program, I would not be able to see those things. I wouldn't. I just know that I would be pulling strings and confronting people and trying to make it come out some way or other. What I pray for every day is to just stay out of the way and let his higher power work in his life the way mine has worked in my life. I look back at my life, boy, I wasn't doing a very good job. And when I started turning it over to my higher power, he's used these experiences that I would never have thought were going to be mine to turn my life into incredible miracles. Today, my life is filled with wonderful people. I have a good job. I have a great place to live. I feel good about myself. My relationships are with healthy people. I couldn't have done that. So I trust that the same is going to happen for my son. And that's my story. Today, I just need to show up and do what's right in front of me. And all of you are there ready to hold my hand, answer the phone if I need to talk to somebody. Go play with me if the next thing I need to do is play. And I never, ever again have to be alone. I never have to be afraid to just be me. Because I'm okay. I'm okay. And my best is my best. Some days my best is better than other days. But it's always the best I've got. And that turns out to be good enough for God. And that's good enough for me. Thank you very much for coming.